Hello, and welcome to The Exit, presented by Flippa.com, the number one platform to buy and sell online businesses. Flippa manages over $1 billion in deal value annually and combines expert buy and sell side advisory with its market-leading valuation tool, deal room, off-market offering, market insights, and AI-based deal-by-deal matching engine. Now for The Exit. The Exit is a 30-minute podcast featuring amazing entrepreneurs who have been there and they have done it. The Exit talks to operators who have bought and sold businesses of all different sizes. You'll learn how they did it, why they did it, and get exposure to the world of exits. It's a world occupied by a small few, but accessible to many. Now, on this special episode, I sit down with Adam Martell. He's currently the CEO and founder of Givzy, a give now, pay later model that's really brilliant. And we had a lot of fun talking about his previous company, Gravity. And just going through the whole process of changing where his customers were getting his product, it was a slight nuance from being a platform where people were not really logging in and identifying that to pushing that same data that they were getting from the dashboard on their platform to their email, changed their business to the point where they did a $1 million quarter and exited to a private equity company called K1. It's a really great story from start to finish, scaling his company to 50 people, going through this exit. And we also connected a lot on Babson College in Boston. I spent a lot of time in Boston over the years, and it's a really great conversation. So without further ado, let's sit down and have our conversation here on The Exit with Adam Martell. All right. I am here with Adam Martell, the CEO and founder of Givzy. How's it going, Adam?
Hey, Steve. It's good to be here.
All right. I'm excited to unpack your exit and your successes that you've had. But before we get there, let's talk about your background. How did you get into business and entrepreneurship?
Yeah, my dad was an entrepreneur. And growing up, I just sort of saw the highs and the lows of entrepreneurship. My mother worked in fundraising, and I was just always the kid that was inventing something. I was the lemonade stand kid. I was the kid in school that just, you know, I'd get an assignment and I would just start dreaming. And I remember there was one year, it was fifth, sixth grade, I got an assignment to create like a new sport. In my mind, just like, I went nuts. I got a bunch of kids together. We were testing different things. And looking back, it was like early MVP stuff that that was just so much fun. And I loved inventing. After college, I started an advertising agency. It's called Arm Advertising, which we sold, and then tried to start a set of healthy convenience stores. Failed with those, and along that path, I was a men's and women's volleyball coach for a long time. Got in fundraising, was in banking for a little while, and I was just trying a bunch of different things. And I loved coaching. Was trying to supplement my coaching income with businesses that I started, and just love entrepreneurship. Love starting businesses, and I took a job at Babson, and I met my co-founder there that I started Gravity with, and it just started to take off, and we really, really, really had a good run with that company, learned a lot, and sort of led us to Givzy.
Nice. And a fun story about Babson, because we were talking about this before in Boston. I knew a lot of Babson students, and it was like the back in late like 2013, 2014 timeframes, people were all eager to drop out of Babson, like say that you got in and then drop out to start a business. It was like this whole pitch to start up. And was that the case? Did you guys drop out? Did you finish? Or was it a job as like a teacher? What was the relationship at Babson?
Yeah, no. So I just finished my coaching career. I was working in fundraising at the time in advancement. I took a job in advancement. My co-founder, Rich, he was on a full scholarship for the 2-year full-time program. I was nights and weekends. So I was working a full-time job, trying to start my next business. And I went to Babson to find a co-founder and to really be part of the culture. Mm-hmm. Ended up dropping out of the MBA program midway through because we raised money. And, you know, I was the CEO, and I just, you know, you can't raise money and commit to certain things, have a family, and also, you know, go to school. I didn't think so. I dropped out midway. But even to this day, my dad says, hey, you know, you might want to consider just going back and finishing. I don't think I ever will. But that's changed over the years. But yeah, I think I was never one to idolize dropping out. I was always the goal was to start another company and to sort of be part of the right culture. And I got that. So I'd love to go back eventually, but the goal was never to drop out. But I remember that time where everyone was, I think Peter Thiel was paying people to drop out of college and the MBA program and, you know, teach their own. But, you know, I think it's case by case. I never idolized dropping out. I just didn't finish.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's right. Peter Thiel, like the Thiel Fellowship and all that was really gaining momentum. So I would assume that Babson sort of embraced it after a while, saying like, hey guys, these two people started a company, they raised some money, like go do your thing. You know, it's like I would assume that they embraced it and were supportive eventually after so many people were really following that path.
Yeah, it was an interesting trajectory because I was working during the day and at lunch I would take a class. The classes at Babson, the entrepreneurship program at Babson is always ranked number one, and it should be ranked number one. I mean, Babson is the very best entrepreneurship school in the world in terms of the professors, but also the culture that they sort of create. And when you're working there, it's a little bit different because you have your job, you know, in fundraising and. You know, I think the expectations that you're going to sort of work for the college and be part of the college second. But no, I was always supported as an entrepreneur there. And I was always really grateful for my time. And, you know, it was definitely, there were a couple of hiccups around just, you know, can you balance everything? Can you hit your goals? And luckily I was a good fundraiser. So I was hitting my goals. So I think I got a lot of leeway. But the other component was that the company I was starting was directly related to my job. So you know, it was an AI company that was to support frontline fundraisers. So I was literally building the company while I was fundraising, and the company was helping me fundraise more efficiently. So it all sort of worked out. But they were super supportive, and I loved my time at Babson.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, and I've always heard great, fantastic things about Babson. Everybody I know that went through programs there always speaks highly. So it's a good segue into Gravity. So it started with a co-founder. You raised money while you were at Babson. You guys left and you started this company. How long did you operate it and what KPIs were you guys tracking for success?
Yeah, so early on, the KPIs were, can we get a customer, right? I mean, going zero to one is moving one set of mountains. Can you get a customer? And we found early on we could get a couple customers, but we couldn't get usage on the product. So the actual KPI was, can we get anybody to use this darn thing? We went through the process of raising money. We went through the process of leaving. You know, I left my job. Rich, you know, he had finished his MBA program, but he had an offer at a company. It was a really good offer, and he decided to turn it down so he could pursue this with me. And we had a great run, but the real KPI was usage. We were developing at the beginning dashboards, and the thesis was that because nonprofits have all this data in their database, AI and technology should really help the fundraisers utilize that data and should harness that data to enable frontline fundraisers to raise money more efficiently and build more relationships. And the real math problem was we had 40,000 alumni at Babson, and we had 10 frontline fundraisers, and we all had 200 donors in our portfolio. So we were only managing around 2,000 of the 40,000. So we were barely 5% of the entire donor pool that we were actually building relationships with. So the question was, could you use technology to double the portfolio sizes of the fundraisers? And we created these dashboards that would predict which donors would make the next biggest gift. So if you had 400 donors in the dashboard, they would move up and down every single day. And the thesis was that if we gave a frontline fundraiser the ability to focus on the top 5 or 10 donors, that they would be more efficient than if they just got a list of donors and they started picking the people they knew, which was what was happening. The problem is that nobody logged into the dashboards. And so we had all these KPIs that we were trying to measure around logins and usage and gifts related to usage. And they just weren't connecting. Customers were saying, you know, we bought this because we believe the thesis, but our fundraisers aren't logging into the dashboard. And we conclusively proved that fundraisers wouldn't log into a dashboard outside of their CRM. So the KPI became, could we get them to use it? And we put all the dashboards into email, started pushing the dashboards out through email, making the frontline fundraisers sort of look at it every day. And we called it a UI-less CRM experience. And that gave us the ability to say conclusively that every day, every frontline fundraiser was looking at the data and being influenced by it. And after a while, we sort of heard that that was the way the frontline fundraisers wanted to interact with a secondary system, not a primary CRM, but a secondary data system. was being pushed to them through email. And that's when the company took off. We started developing self-writing emails from there. Usage went through the roof. Leads, you know, it was typical funnel metrics. It was, the cold leads to warm leads, to demos, to contracts, to closes. They just started to go through the roof. And that's when the company took off.
Nice. Nice. So just that slight tweak of, you know, having it as the platform where people weren't really logging into a UI-less email push, basically, to give them the same information, same data. It's such a fun nuance of how things can really take off with just thinking through where people are, where they're engaging the most, and going there with the product. It's a great one. So with the, you know, start to see success, let's talk about the, you know, the initial conversations. How did conversations about exiting begin?
Yeah. So, I think 2019, 2018, PE firms were doing a really, really, really good job of building relationships. There was one guy at the firm we ended up selling to, James, who was just the kindest, smartest, most empathetic guy. He would call every month, every 2 months, say, "Hey, Adam, how you doing? Like, how's everything going?" You know, a lot of these bigger PE firms, they have their own businesses to run. So they have a lot of essentially SDRs that are going out, building relationships with CEOs, trying to get information, tracking progress. And James in particular just did a really, really great job at K1 of building a really long-term relationship. And I think that's what K1 is really known for is being founder friendly, supporting their founders well, and making sure that the founders know that, that they're supported through the process. And they just did a fantastic job of that. So the early conversations, you know, I had talked to about 30 PE firms, some venture firms, and some just sort of buyout firms, some M&A opportunity. And we started taking some of the inbound calls. Whenever we travel, I had all these lists of, you know, if I'm in New Orleans, I'm going to reach out to the 3 VC firms and 3 PE firms in New Orleans, see if I can have a quick coffee with folks. And people reaching out and then trying to make sure that you're following up in a kind way, in a professional way, to make sure that you're giving as much information as you can, not oversharing, not undersharing, not trying to play any games, just, you know, you're building a company and being proud of that and communicating what you're doing well. So those were the early conversations. Some of them were really aggressive. Some of them were just information gathering because we were either too small or too big or not in the right sector. But there were a few of the 30 or 40 that we talked to that just hit the mark.
Nice. And what did negotiations look like? Did you shop it around and how did that work?
Yeah. So there were 3 PE firms at the very, we weren't really looking to sell. The board encouraged us to continue to grow because we had just hit, I think, a $750,000 quarter. And 4 or 5 quarters before, we had done like $30,000. I mean, it was just, it was crazy. And the board kept saying, "Listen, let's hold here. Let's hold." And we talked to a bunch of the PE firms, just sort of told them about our growth. And one of the PE firms called and said, we have a term sheet we want to give you. We know this space better than anybody." And so we called the other 2 or 3 PE firms just to let them know what was going on because we had great conversations with these folks, and we really picked the 3 or 4 that we really wanted to work with. And of the 4, there were 3 that put in term sheets. And we chose 2 and started working with those 2 and then narrowed it down to the final one and ended up selling to K1.
Nice. Nice. And with the deal with K1, was it, how did that process work? Was it, because I've talked to a lot of people that have gone through acquisitions with PE firms, but I'd love to hear from your take, you know, what was the whole end-to-end process timeline wise, and you know, what was it like going through?
Yeah, I'd met with the PEO with the K1 folks probably about a year before, and we'd just given updates. They'd helped us out with a couple introductions. They were really kind with introductions. They really communicated. They knew the space well, as did the other 2 PE firms that were sort of the top 3. They all knew the space really well. And because we're a nonprofit tech, it's sort of this side, very verticalized solution. So we wanted a PE firm that really understood nonprofit tech, not just SaaS. And K1 had already invested in a nonprofit tech firm. So when things got serious, I think it was probably September that we really started the conversations, maybe end of August. And in about 3 or 4 days later, 1 or 2 of their team members flew out. I was in California, talked to one of the folks there. two or three of their team members flew out a couple days later and presented the term sheet. But they had done such a good job of doing their homework leading up to that point and being ready to be able to offer a term sheet. They were so well prepared, really kind, and really they did what they said that they were going to do from beginning to end. So I think the negotiations were probably about a week, 2 weeks. Diligence was about 30, maybe 45 days, something like that. They went pretty deep in their diligence. They did a great job. Whenever you're going through diligence, I think it feels incredibly painful, invasive, intrusive. But looking back, you know, they're making a huge investment in the team and the technology and the customers and in the process. And they did a really, really great job of being thorough with diligence. And then we closed the deal and we sold the majority. And then we stayed on for another 2 years to ultimately merge the company with the other nonprofit tech company in their portfolio.
Nice. This podcast is brought to you by Flippa.com, the leading global platform to buy and sell online businesses. Do you need a valuation for your business? Have you asked yourself, who would buy my business? Flippa has a leading valuation tool. It's free to use and based on thousands of historical sales. To get a valuation or to schedule a call with an advisor, head to flippa.com/free valuation. Now, back to the show. And how big was the team at that point that you grew?
At the point of the merger?
Yeah.
So in 2021, the team was probably 50, 45, 50. So it wasn't a huge, huge company, but we had my last quarter there, we had hit $1 million quarter, which for us was the gold standard. Whenever you go, a startup, whenever you're talking to investors, it's when can you hit that first $1 million quarter? And that was the first time we hit it. And that was, that's great traction there. And that was really a tribute to the team, to K1's partnership and, to the support they gave us. I think they did a really good job through the process.
Nice. And you were there for 2 years-ish after the deal. Did all 50, trickle out and go do other things, or did they stick around? How did that work?
Yeah, so some of them stuck around, some of them left. Whenever you go through sort of M&A, there's always sort of transition with leadership. I think they did a really good job of managing the transition process for a lot of the executives. Obviously, I think they were fair with me, with my co-founder. They just did a good job of sort of managing the process there. And I think probably half the team is still there and half the team moved on.
Nice. Yeah. And I've talked to a lot of people and I think there's such a winning feeling that you get when team members are still at a company after it's gone through an exit. There's such a great feeling that comes with it. So let's talk about timing. A question that comes up a lot is when is the right time? So a tip you could share with an entrepreneur out there listening to this, why was it the right time for you to sell? And what could you share with someone about timing?
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody about this. It's such a unique situation because let's say these PE firms are talking to you for 3 years and you're going from zero to one. And you're trying to get your first customer, and the PE firm, or a VC or any buyout firm or any large M&A player, they keep saying, well, if you get to $1 million, you'd be more in our sweet spot. You get to 2 million, you'd be more in our sweet spot. It's actually, you can go through sort of 2 or 3 years of just growth and then have a huge quarter and trade on that big quarter. And it looks like that moving forward. It really just takes that inflection point. And I think for us, the $750,000 quarter that we closed, that was a real inflection point for us. I mean, we knew that we had something. We knew that, at that point, the price was only going to go up. We were sure that we were going to close more customers. We were closing more 3-year deals. Value of that company was going to go up. So I think it was a great story to be able to honestly tell PE firms that, if you wait on a deal, there's no way that you're going to get the deal you're going to get today because we're growing at a pace that you're just not going to get this deal. And I think that's where you want to be. You want to be as honest as possible and you want to put yourself in a position where you're not trying to sell an undervalued asset for way too much money. I think especially in this economy now, valuations have gone down. You want to make sure that you're selling value because you have to stick around for a couple of years sometimes. And if you do, you want to make sure that you're not always coming from behind. For us, we sold right before COVID, and we sold in November, went through December of planning, January of planning, and COVID hit in February, March, and it was wild. I mean, everything's turned upside down. We were a smaller portfolio company, so I think there was less, not less pressure, but they just sort of considered supporting us. We were almost one of their most recent investments, and there were maybe one after us, but we were early in the process there. Mm-hmm. And they just did a great job partnering with us. They kept saying, listen, we're going to support you. We're going to support the company. There's no way that we're not going to support this company. It has value. We're going to support it. And they did what they said they were going to do. And so I think the right time in terms of any exit or any M&A is just when you have a good story to tell, when the story is continuing to get better, and when you truly believe that you have something that will be more valuable in the future, because exits are really about, somebody else buying something at a certain moment when it might be more valuable in the future and cost them more in the future. I mean, that's really what exits are driven by.
Mm-hmm. Well said. And how about preparedness? What tips could you give about being prepared to go through it?
I never realized how important RevRec was. I never realized how important, early on in companies, you try to close a deal almost any way that you can. You give 3-year contracts, you give 5-year contracts, you give start dates on the contracts. When we went through the M&A process with K1, they looked at every single contract. Their lawyers looked at every contract, and RevRec starts when the contract says that it starts. So I think being really, really careful about your financials, it doesn't have to be anything crazy. You can hire a temp CFO or you can learn RevRec pretty easily, but making sure that when you say contracts start, they start. When you say they end, they end. Making sure that your contracts align with when you're taking revenue on each contract was a huge learning for us. Making sure the team is in place and making sure that the team feels supported through the process. I think that was something Rich and I did really well. I think our team always felt like we just, we're trying like heck to make sure that this company has the ability to grow, and we don't want to be coming from behind, and we don't want to partner with the wrong partner. So making sure the team feels supported through it. And then just making sure that you continue to win. I think we had a winning culture. We wanted to win pretty much at all costs. We just wanted to win. And it was really important for us to make sure that we stayed focused on winning while we were going through the M&A process and the exit process. I think some founders confuse exits for winning. They're not. It's sort of raising money, exiting, if you have to stick around, if you have an earnout, if you have things like that, you're going to have to deliver on the things you promised. So making sure that you keep a winning culture and that you don't get too far ahead of your skis promising things you can't deliver on, because there's nothing worse than losing, period. And there's really nothing worse than losing when you sort of enter into a relationship like an exit and you stick around as a CEO. And I think we did a good job of setting expectations and hitting those expectations.
Got it. Well said. I like that. Expectations. So knowing what you know now, what would you tell Adam 10 years ago?
Probably say focus on building really, really, really great fundamental companies. Just making sure that I think most entrepreneurs that are really great, and I'm not saying I am, but I think most entrepreneurs that are really great have the ability to influence people around them in positive ways and negative ways. I would stay focused on all the ways that you can influence people in a positive way. At Gravity, the day we stopped being in the office, there was one day for COVID. We just said, hey, we're going to test this out today. I think it was like a Wednesday or Thursday. And then on Friday, everything got shut down. We never went back to the office ever again. That Monday, we started a morning meeting. And that morning meeting carried us 2.5-3 years. We never got rid of it. We started the morning meeting at Givzy with 2 employees. And now we're at 8. And we have a morning meeting every single day. And it's a 15-minute catch-up. And that's what I would say. I would say that the things that people believe matter sometimes don't matter as much as the little things people don't think matter at all. Every time I talk to an entrepreneur who's looking for an investment, or every time I talk to an investor who's looking for ways to build culture in one of their portfolio companies, we always ask, how many times do entrepreneurs have morning meetings? And we've never met a company that has a consistent morning meeting every morning. And 10 years ago, I wish I had known that the small things matter sometimes more than the big things, that culture matters, that being empathetic and kind to your employees really, really matters. It's not as cutthroat as everybody says it is. Making sure people know that you're fighting for them and not with them or against them. And taking care of the people who take care of you. I just, we're so proud of the cultures that we built at these companies. We had a whole bunch of working parents and we just had flexibility. I mean, the number one saying at the company was, you're not measured by how many hours you spend in your seat. You're measured by how much impact you make on our culture, our team, and our customers. And I think that the ability to be flexible to support different lifestyles is probably the one of the most important things that I've learned over the last 10 years. And it keeps people going in hard times and it really accelerates growth in good times.
Very well said. I like it. So what are you working on now? And let's talk a little bit about Givzy.
Yeah. So Givzy, I started probably 3 weeks after I left Gravity and it's just such a great space. So one of the things I wanted to do in the new company was create a category. Like we did at Gravity, I really enjoy category creation. My favorite position to be in is everybody telling me no and me having that feeling of like, no, this is definitely something. You got to trust me on this one. Just give me a little more time. So Givzy is the first Give Now, Pay Later company really focused on donations for nonprofits. We took the Buy Now, Pay Later model, applied it to giving. And so what we're trying to do is use flexible giving options like Give Now, Pay Later to allow donors to split their gifts so that they can make larger impacts on the organizations that they love. There was never anything like it before we created it. And we didn't invent the Buy Now, Pay Later space, obviously, but the transition to Give Now, Pay Later was our invention. It was sort of the creation that we came up with. And it's turned out to be right. Donors giving, $1,000 over 4 months allows them to make a larger impact than if they could only give $250 in 1 month because their sort of weekly or monthly budget might prohibit them from making a larger gift. More flexible giving options is sort of what we're working on. But Give Now, Pay Later is the product. And it's been successful so far. It's been growing at a great pace. And I think over the next year or two, we're going to see that Give Now, Pay Later will become one of the dominant forces in nonprofit giving.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. Social good. Very, very nice. Well, those are all the questions I have for you, Adam. Wherever you guys are listening on iTunes or Spotify, the links that Adam mentioned will be in the show notes. But thanks so much for coming on.
Steve, thanks so much for having me.